And that's what they found, the Gottmans. They found that actually your methods around conflict, your methods around criticism, defensiveness, whether you shut down and kind of retreat in the middle of an argument, whether you, you know, kind of blow up, lose your temper, start calling names in an argument, like it's the way you negotiate that actually is the stronger determinant of long-term relationship success than compatibility or novelty and adventure and, you know, connection over various hobbies. Like, it's pretty interesting.
Boom, boom, boom. Guess who is in my waiting room? Never done that before, but what the heck? Kick those tires and start that extremely fake fire, because gas prices, prohibitive as they are, have forced us into virtual consultations, even with friends of friends, including my dear friend, Matthias Barker, renowned Christian psychotherapist, which I love that term. We're going to get into psychotherapist and why that term is different than others. He has grown to incredible. He is Instagramus, if I can actually make that a word.
Wow.
He has been on TV, actually, as actually someone who's been consulted by leading authorities. Also, just a genuinely great human being, a rare trifecta that you find in a human being. He has rocketed up the top of the TikTok and Instagram charts, if that's such a thing. Wow. And now he is basically, he and I are essentially identical. Aside from he's more well-read and has 5,987,000 more listeners and followers than I do. Please welcome to the virtual campfire, my dear friend, Matthias J. Barker.
That's such a warm welcome. I feel so flattered, and I'm so excited to meet this Matthias Barker you're talking of. This is great.
Well, yeah, that's sort of, I guess so. Matthias also struggles with multiple personalities, so he has very famous ones. So, no, but we shouldn't joke about that. It is a serious thing. We have limited time today because, let's face it, the world is full of chaos and Matthias and I have to go deal with it. However, in big updates in Matthias's life, you have a new client that you brought into the house since we last talked.
Yes, the little one. My wife is pregnant. Not a client. I think my children will decry having a therapist as a father.
True, and you don't make money off them. They will actually drain you financially.
That's
so this more of a charity. You brought in a cause.
So. Yeah, hopefully they don't feel like a client. But we have a little one coming in August. Little boy. It's our second. So we're pretty stoked. Life is good right now.
Oh, I was saying last time we met on Kinda Christian, for you listeners out there who enjoy my theological waxing on our other podcast, you had not welcomed the new addition to your house yet. So how is fatherhood?
Yeah, just celebrated a year. Two days ago.
Amazing.
How about that? I know, time flies, huh? It's been a long time. Yeah. So our first little girl, her name is Etta. She just celebrated a year old 2 days ago, and we had a big assortment of charcuterie plates that she did not partake in, and balloons and it's so funny. Throwing a birthday party for a 1 year old is so much more about the adults, I guess, than the child, aside from them getting to eat the cake at the end. But it was pretty fun. We had a good time with it.
There's a Seinfeld bit on that where he says your first birthday and your last birthday are actually the same. You're sort of not really present. You don't really know what's going on. They put cake in front of you. They invite a bunch of people which you don't recognize. And they say, these are your friends. Welcome them to your birthday party. So
that's awesome. That's really, I think, encapsulates it well. Yeah.
But fatherhood's amazing. So I mean, what is the take home? What are you surprised about with fatherhood? And, if there's such a thing as, maybe not miss is the right word, but what do you appreciate more now that you have a child?
Yeah. Well, I think I got the advice early on from a good mentor that just said that, hey, you know, I called the mentor asking, I was like, what's your advice on fatherhood? And he's like, you don't need to be worrying about that for the first couple of years. Just don't even think about it. What you need to worry about is making sure your wife enjoys being a mom. Yeah. For the first couple of years, you're just focused on making sure your wife enjoys, you know, being a mom, and you're not imparting all these philosophical lessons. You're not trying to instantiate all these habits, and you're not doing Bible studies and having him read Homer and Aristotle. You're just,
that's your two,
you know, you're just, changing diapers and making sure that baby's doing okay and living and not getting a diaper rash. And, you know, like it's pretty mundane, glorious stuff. And so really the primary focus, if we're thinking about okay, what kind of family do I want to build? What kind of habits do I want to build? What is the actual, the qualities of family life has a lot more to do with your spouse actually in that first couple of years, because in terms of your child, it's not to it's not too deep and philosophical, which I thought was, it's like self-evident advice, but once it hits you, it's like, oh, it really just helped you kind of prioritize stuff. So when baby got here, I was just really focused on Paige and really making sure she was having a good time. So that was a great choice. I think that really,
you would advise other future parents for those with little ones on the way, you would say this advice is proven true.
Yeah. I think so. I think it's been good. So it's, excellent. I think even with second, you know, babe coming into play, it's kind of same strategy. I'm not, again, Etta is not really even talking. She has a couple words. She has like, she can say hot, which is kind of funny. When there's like a hot, like cup, like every morning we drink coffee and she's always reaching for the coffee and we're like, no, hot. And so now when we have coffee, she'll look over and be like, oh, hot. I'm like, yeah, hot.
So she likes the song Hot Hot. And for our listeners, so she's actually not downing coffee. You know, it's actually funny. My when I was a little child, you know, a few years ago, my parents gave me coffee, what they called coffee. And it was like 4/5 milk and like a few drops of coffee just to give it a sort of a latte flavor. And it was called hot. Yeah. That's what it was. Because I would just say that. And I had a little plastic cup. And, you know, you put enough cream and sugar in anything, it's marvelous. So yeah, that's amazing. That's and then what do you miss, if anything, or what do you appreciate more now that you're in the sleepless, and you know, parental, you know, different side of the, of life? Do you have an appreciation for things from the other seasons?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think I'm in a uniquely fortunate spot where Paige and I were married for almost 9 years before we had kids. And so,
wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got married real young. She was 19. I was 20. And so we had a lot of time just to like go out to eat and go to movies and enjoy, I don't know, like being just childless and all the fun.
So you couldn't legally drink at your wedding?
Nope. But I drank on our honeymoon in Mexico because 18 is the law there. So that was actually my first drink was in Mexico. And I got like a double of some Jack and tried to drink whiskey for the first time. And it was gross and did not like it. And then I just ate pina coladas for the rest of the time. So, ooh,
all right, well, there you go.
That was my 19-year-old experience.
I'm curious, you know, people all the time, it's funny, I just saw a post on this on Instagram, which is perhaps eerily prophetic here. When you get married that young, did everyone around you say, what are you doing? You're too young. I'm fascinated with this as we get into this sort of like what constitutes an adult now. We talked, I think last time I'd read Ben Sasse's book, The Vanishing American Adult, and it unfortunately hit way closer to home than I would have liked. Because it's interesting how they actually, he said, and I think I may be paraphrasing this hopefully correctly, is that they've actually moved the definition of what is considered adulthood back further. So it's actually into the 30s. Because I'm like, I'm now 36 and I feel just as immature as I was a long time ago, albeit with more financial means to express that immaturity.
Yeah.
But do people are like, hey, when you get married that young, it seems so unfathomable to me. Like you have, like, I think about myself at 20 and I'm like, dear God, no. Like, but then I go, most of history, you got married at what, 16, 17, you know? So what was your experience?
Well, life expectancy was only, you know, into your 40s for a majority of human history.
So did you mature quicker or did you just, you know, die early? That's a quote, you know?
Yeah, it's like if childhood ends in your 30s, then I guess just all of life is majority childhood. I don't know.
That's, well, that's been borne out by a lot of things we've seen out there. But did people tell you too young?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in some ways they're right, but like most of the people that we knew are friends who kind of followed suit and got married kind of right after freshman year of college in that 1920 world. Most of them are divorced now, not all, but most of them are.
Really?
And I mean, it makes sense. It's like, you know, you don't really know who you are at age 19 or 20. And the process of change that you're going through from ages like 19 to 23 is just so drastic. Like you're likely going to have, if not an entirely different worldview, very, very different sorts of values and very different sorts of hobbies. And, you know, you could think of like the trellis that you build your relationship on when you're 19, the things that are important to you, the things that you do, the music you listen to, all those kinds of things, that trellis is getting completely swapped out and changed and altered, you know, over the course of your early 20s to where you're probably a very different kind of person when you're 25. So you know, if you were being cynical, you could just say, well, you know, you better hope that you like the person that they turned into at age 25, because that's who you're kind of, you know, hitched up to. I don't think it's that cut and dry. I think that Paige and I both really had sturdy values in our faith. And we grew up in a pretty similar I don't know, childhood experience, growing up in youth group and growing up with parents who hold really similar values. And so a lot of those core things that really animate us were in place and stayed in place, you know, kind of throughout our early adulthood. So that helped. And then, I mean, on a personality spectrum, we're pretty similar in a lot of categories. And even as hobbies have changed and styles have changed and our jobs looked different, you know, kind of moving through everything, we stayed pretty close, you know. And I think, you know, the Gottmans did interesting research on this.
Oh, love Gottman.
Yeah. So they looked at, okay, what's the better predictor of marriage stability? Is it, you know, the habits that someone has at the beginning of a relationship, or like the deteriorating effects of time? Because you could theorize that, like, eventually you're going to get bored of each other. Eventually, you know, you're just going to kind of turn into these different people. Like I was saying, that cynical view of just like, you're going to have different hobbies, potentially different values, you know, later on in life than you did early on. So is that the heavier, more, you know, determinant variable? Or are there things actually just even in your interactions early on that are a heavier variable? And that's what they found, the Gottmans. They found that actually your methods around conflict, your methods around criticism, defensiveness, whether you shut down and kind of retreat in the middle of an argument, whether you, you know, kind of blow up, lose your temper, start calling names in an argument, like it's the way you negotiate that actually is the stronger determinant of long-term relationship success than compatibility or novelty and adventure and, you know, connection over various hobbies. Like, it's pretty interesting.
So as a successful sales executive, I should have success in marriage. Be like, yeah, look,
thanks. You're just very persuasive.
Here's the deal. All right. Have I got an option for you? Right. Here's what are you doing for dinner tonight? Right. Oh man, have I got several choices for you? So your faith grounded you two together. But actually, this is one of the questions we got from our listeners here was, yeah, how do you, you know, what is your, if you boil it down, what do you feel has made marriage work for you? And it sounds like a strong faith and commitment to that has helped you weather those storms and the changes that would come, because you're a different person today than you were at 20, right? I mean, would you say you've changed substantially?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think all of us are the same and different in various ways, but yeah, I think the things that kept us grounded, faith is one. It's also maybe one to tack on top of that would be that I think Paige and I have really kept at the center of our relationship that we believe each other when we say that we're on the same team. Like when you're arguing over something, when you have a disagreement, even when there's a moment of betrayal or hurt, there's the temptation to kind of concede that, hey, you and I are on different teams and we're fighting for different things. And so I need to kind of protect what's mine. I need to protect me. I need to get the blame off of me and onto you. You know, there's kind of a point keeping system, like, and that's protective. That makes sense. It's not bad to do that. It's like a normal response, but towards the end of long-term relational closeness, it can complicate things. It can make things more complex, because if you kind of go into an argument with a preservative, protective state of mind, and you go in negotiating almost on the precondition that only one of us can win here, either I can get my thing or you can get your thing, and I got to fight for my thing, then you're going to go in way more accusational. You're going to go in with a lot more criticism. You're going to go in with a lot more, even just the energy of just some heat, just some anger, some coldness, that's going to disrupt your ability to have like a good negotiation or a good conversation on something. But if you go in instead with that warmth of, oh, you and I are on the same team. We're actually trying to get to the same goal here. We have the same dream around what our lives could look like, then that changes the whole tinge of the conversation. So for example, like it's kind of abstract, but for example, would be like, you know, let's say that I'm running home late from work consistently. And let's say that I'm like 30, 40 minutes late from work because I'm just sitting around on my phone, I'm on TikTok, I'm just kind of like moseying around. Maybe I grab a coffee on my way home or something. And then, you know, Paige is maybe frustrated and says like, hey, I'm here alone with the baby. Like, you know, there's a lot of different ways that arguments could go down. You know, if she went in, like, essentially he's being selfish. He doesn't care about me and my time. He just thinks that I'm just over here as like, you know, glorified childcare where he can kind of go around and do whatever he wants with his life and then pop in when he feels like it. You know, if that was really the underlying belief, then that's going to set the tone for the conversation. And she could come in, you know, really hot and just say like, hey, Matthias, like, I'm like, oh, finally decided to show up. Like, welcome home. Yeah, you want me to cook you dinner too? Like, there's a there's an underlying
great to be home.
Yeah, like there's an underlying anger and criticism that's it's going to make it near impossible for us to actually negotiate. If anything, I'm just going to try to appease her just to get her to stop being so angry or stop yelling at me. And so then I'm just going to, like, her best case scenario, if she came at it from that point of view, would be just to, for me to appease her. But instead, if we kind of acknowledge, you know, we have the same goal here, like my guess is that if Matthias knew how tired I was and really kind of the laborious nature of caring after like a one-year-old all day long and that I haven't been able to go to the bathroom by myself all day and that I haven't even gotten a shower in yet today, or that I am trying to cook and watch her, but she didn't take her nap. And so it's been really like, if he knew the context of what I'm actually dealing with, then he would probably be moved and want me to flourish too. Like, and so there's almost this underlying assumption that like, oh, like he cares about me, he loves me. And if he really understood, then he would value and we'd actually probably reach a similar conclusion. And so coming in and be like, hey, just want to let you know about kind of what my day has been like. This has been really hard. It would be so helpful, you know, for you to come home 30 minutes earlier, an hour earlier, so that I can get dinner started, so that I can, I don't know, just even get a little bit of time for myself, because I just feel so exhausted. And when you're home late, like I feel really fatigued and really tired. And and I would feel so supportive, so supported, if, you know, we agreed upon the time when you would be home. So I know when to expect you. So I, as I'm kind of managing the household, like I know when you're going to be home. It's going to set a totally different tone.
For sure. The irony of this example is that you have had phenomenal success on TikTok through consistency. And so if you were 30 minutes late and you were posting on TikTok, you could, how am I speaking? I'm making a living here. I got to be on TikTok. I don't want to sit there and swipe right on dancing pictures all day, but I'm doing it, you know? So there's a,
I'm working. Yeah.
I'm working on TikTok. Also, shouldn't have that coffee later in the day. Could keep you up all night, but you're going to be up all night with a kid anyway. But no, that's interesting. I mean, it's interesting. So you're talking conflict resolution. Actually, I forget if it was Gary, one of the two big Christian authors on, it was called The Sacred Search, and it was on finding a mate, but he had four criteria that he said, you need to rate someone you're with. You need to actually be as critical as you can be. Like if you're considering them for, you know, long-term right. merger, you know, that one, there are four categories, and if they don't score a 36, basically a scale of 1 to 10, if you don't get a 9s on average across the board, you need to, like, this is not a fit. And the one of the big ones is a conflict resolution. He said the best couples will fight 20% of the time. Like that's the gold standard you can go for, is 6 days of the week you'll be fine, but there will be, you know, just arguments. Yeah. And how you are able to communicate and handle those is a huge determinant of your, like, lifetime success. So I love that Will Ferrell quote about, if you want to find out who someone is, just put them in front of slow internet for an hour and see what happens.
That's funny. Yeah, that's actually a great one. Yeah, no, I think that's a huge value, being able to see how someone responds to conflict and feeling like, okay, we can negotiate, we can repair, even when there is a rupture, even when there is something bad that happens, we can, you know, that's not turned into a grudge. Yeah. That's not turned into a resentment. That's not leveraged later on to manipulate me to do things.
Why do you think, so it's funny. I love what you're saying here about conflict resolution. And I actually didn't even plan on getting into this, but, you know, obviously asking for a friend, because I'd never struggle with this. But why do you think humans just immediately go to the dark side when it comes, like, when we have conflicts, it's always like, you know what? Matthias is out to get me. I knew it all along. He never liked me. It was like, you know, you always like have this conspiratorial, and then you get there and it's like, sorry, I'm late. Like, traffic was terrible and I stopped to get you some flowers. You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, like, it's so funny. I just have this tendency always to be like, just assume, like, and I find this in a lot of conflict that either I have and friends have had, where it's like, we tend to assume in conflict the other person is just like totally against us and out to get us. And it doesn't even logically make sense. Like, I'm thinking about your example with your wife. Like, you both have the same, we want our kid to flourish. We want peace in our household. We both want dinner. We both, like, you know, we both want rest. Like, we are, if you literally line up our Maslowian hierarchy of needs, they're almost all the same.
Right.
And so it's interesting that we default to, you know, the worst case scenario.
Totally. Well, and that's so hard to keep in the front of our mind. Our incentives are aligned. And if you go into the argument assuming that they're not, you'll likely end the argument as if they're not. It's a powerful thing.
Do you think that's just the fallen nature of humanity? I mean, is it just our?
Well, I mean, I think in part, I mean, there's a few things. It's probably complex. One of them might be that there's a pattern of behavior that even though I've told you, hey, it's really tiring. Hey, I'm exhausted. It'd be great if you're home on time. You still don't show up on time, and not even for good reasons, but it's just because you're on TikTok. So there's experiences that confirm that you're just being selfish or distracted. And so then what we do is we fear that, you know, before we have really even any evidence, before we know one way or the other why someone's late, we just assume that it's for the bad reasons that we've seen in the past, right? So it's complex. It's not just a matter of us being cynical. Sometimes it's us pulling off of past times when our partners let us down. That's one of them. Another one might be that we're just generally protective. Like sometimes things happen that like kind of ring through a past series of wounds, like a past constellation of events in our past that that made us feel vulnerable or unsafe or unprotected.
Yeah.
Like, no. I mean, like a classic example could be, you know, feeling unsafe, you know, in a relationship with someone because we had a parent that was really inconsistent, you know? So when our partner does something that reminds us of dad or reminds us of mom, then we react not just with the intensity of that isolated circumstance, but with the intensity of all the things that we're mad at our mom about, all the things we're mad about at our dad about, and our partner. So I think, yeah, fallen in one sense, you could say it's fallenness, but it's more specific than that. There's a very specific sense in which it's fallen, maybe something like that.
Sometimes people challenge me and they say, I don't think humans are fallen by nature. And I was like, if you just have a 3-year-old unparented and see what happens, it is amazing. They know how to manipulate and lie and push and take things. It's amazing. Like, don't need to work on those values at all. They're just pre-factory settings, you know. Have to get all the other stuff out of it. Well, we got into Gottman way earlier than expected, so I figured, what the heck, why not jump in on this? So you mentioned conflict resolution and also and Gottman's research on what would lead to successful relationships. I am curious, does Gottman have any, or is there in the broader body of literature, is there evidence for restraint and deferred gratification when it comes to sexual behavior leading to long-term healthier outcomes in relationships? And I'm asking that for a couple reasons. One, obviously in sort of Judeo-Christian ethics, there's a priority placed on deferring sexual intimacy until marriage. And I'm curious if that's actually backed up by research to any degree, like the longer you wait, you know, is that better for relationship? Or is that also, that could be because mature people can defer gratification in any area, and that might be predictive of better outcomes and stuff. But have you seen anything like that, or have you come across anything like that?
Well, I think, you know, the first thing that came to mind was some of the literature that, you know, was brought up on masturbation, and specifically there were some questions, you know, kind of in the literature on that, where it's like, hey, you have two people with different libidos, you know, is the best route to take, you know, like if we're looking at different options, that one should just simply repress their erotic desires and just have sex with their partner when the partner is, you know, wanting to have sex. So let's say you have, like, you know, a husband, wife, and, you know, the husband wants to have sex once a month and the wife wants to have sex 2-3 times a week, you know, so should the wife then like hold off and just wait for the once a month for her husband? Or could masturbation be something that's like supplementary? So in the other 9 instances that the husband didn't want to have sex, like, is it okay? And does it lead to marital satisfaction for the wife to then supplement with masturbation? You know, and so there's been studies along those lines. And really the data was shown that it's almost neutral. It has almost no effect whether someone chooses to wait and have sex with their partner when their partner wants to, or whether they masturbate in the meantime. You know, it was actually shown that if that masturbation was in connection to pornography, that it had a negative effect, that led to lower, relational satisfaction.
Okay. I want to come back to it because you mentioned the P word there. We obviously, the M word, anyone can say, but the P word, pornography, YouTube algorithm just suppressed us. Is this research for currently married couples? Or I'm also curious if, like, yeah, if deferring sexual behavior until marriage.
Right. Yeah. So I was,
is that something that has also been looked at?
to be honest, I haven't read that research. Okay. I'm not sure.
I'm curious because some people think, you know, the secular critics might say, well, it's just sort of an antiquated ethic. But I thought I had read somewhere, and I thought it was Gottman, that the ability to defer sexual gratification could actually lead to better outcomes in marriage. My first instinct on that, though, aside from a Christian perspective, would be, well, mature. I mean, that's the test of maturity in all humans, right? Is the ability to delay gratification kind of put that head. But
I might not put it at the feet of delayed gratification, because what I was going to loop around to is with the Gottmans, when they kind of approach this around differenting libidos within marriage, differenting desires of how often we have sex. It was the thing that led to the satisfaction in the relationship was less how similar the sex drives were, or, you know, who had the higher or lower. It was more the communication around sexual connection. And it was, do we know how to negotiate? And that actually ties back around to what we were saying. It's like, do I believe that you actually care about me and want the same thing? Because, I mean, you could assume that, hey, my partner is just essentially doesn't care about me. They don't care about physical connection. They would rather, you know, they just think of me as a roommate. Like, you can go in with all of these hypotheses, or you could go in being like, I mean, they probably understand that I'm a sexual being that has a different drive than them, but if they could have their way, that I guess they would want me to feel satisfied and happy. Like, if they could just pick, I'm sure if it was the pick between me being miserable and and, you know, just sitting here all anxious and, you know, like and then frustrated, or, you know, me feeling connected and warmly attached to them, that they would prefer the attachment. And so then a conversation looks something like a negotiation of, okay, I don't want to have sex several times a week, or I do want to have sex every single day or something. Let's find something that we're both mutually content with. And then, and this is really important, we both consensually agree that that's the method that we're going to take. So whether that's we're going to have sex once a month, but then I'm going to masturbate intermittently, or we're going to have sex two or three times a month and I'm going to wait, and or I'm going to restrain my sexual activity purely to connecting with you. You know, there's that negotiation could actually look really flexible. That wasn't the determining factor, is what they found. It wasn't what they landed on. It's how they negotiated. That was the important part. And that comes back to these methods around criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling, withdraw, contempt. Mm. It's like, do you know how to have a conversation about what's valuable to you and what matters to you? And then do you know how to communicate that with your partner in a way where you maintain good faith, where you maintain that we're probably after the same thing here, even though we're different people? And that was the factor.
Always comes back to communication, huh?
Well, I mean, and there's a couple other things I was going to add too. So the Gottmans also found that the people who had the happiest sex life made sex a priority. So there had to be an understanding that it mattered. And that was actually protective against sex life declining or becoming less satisfying in times of life that typically a sex life kind of tanks, you know, so like around childbearing age, or around illness or chronic pain, you know, life events that aren't really controllable. Like, I mean, I guess you can control whether you have kids or not, but normal seasons of life where, you know, once sex life takes a back seat, do you have conversations with your partner around how do we, within this new context, express physical intimacy, sensual, sexual intimacy together? The styles of communication and the priority of that communication was protective in maintaining a good sex life. So I guess that doesn't really touch on premarital sex or that connection. I guess I haven't really looked into that, but I know that when it comes to having satisfying sex life, those are some things to think through.
Wow. No, that's fascinating, man. You know your stuff. That's so make it a priority. That's yeah. All right. So you brought up pornography, which I'm curious about that.
Sure.
There's no proper context there, but
hey, man, I don't judge you for being curious about pornography.
Well, no, it's funny because I obviously, you know, I'm curious as a Christian psychotherapist. So if you divorce the moral arguments from pornography and just say, look, if we look at it as purely from what is available to us in scientific literature, what would, from your opinion and perspective, what is sort of the consensus, if there is, on pornography in general? As in, I would say in context of mental health and human flourishing, and maybe you want to throw in human relationships are part of flourishing.
I would love if there was a consensus. That would make it so simple.
So there isn't. There's a lot of mixed science.
There's so much. Yeah, there's so many mixed opinions. And I would say, like, I'm not a Christian psychotherapist in the sense that I advertise myself as a psychotherapist who uses Christian modalities or mm-hmm. Christian interventions. I'm a Christian, comma, and I'm a therapist. And right. so, you know, for my clients, I don't maybe impose like the moral dynamic. Right. I don't bring that into the room. And so really, like, when, if my client, for example, like, is, you know, viewing pornography, I don't bring that up unless they specifically voice mm-hmm. that they would like to stop, or maybe this is a problem in their marriage. And so they want to, you know, consider it. And so I take a pretty neutral view, you know, as a clinician, even though privately as a Christian, I hold a moral perspective on pornography not being, mm-hmm. you know, advantageous. But, you know, you could think of, in the psychological realm and the data and the science of it, you have a few different perspectives. You have perhaps like a postmodern perspective that really has taken like a sex positive and, you know, sex positivity, even through the lens of feminist modalities, you know, that really look at the empowerment that pornography can bring, not just to the people that view it, but for the women, you know, the sex workers that perform it. And so there's a lot of theory around how that is actually a liberating act, and that it's something positive, not just for the people married or not who are viewing it, but for the existence of that as a type of media. So there's that perspective. There's other perspectives that look at the efficacy of pornography as it relates to marital satisfaction. And if just generally outside of more like theory, it just on a pragmatic basis, almost, does it lead to marital satisfaction? And the data on that is, I think, and people would contest me here, but I think majority would say that it has a negative correlation to marital satisfaction, but neutral to negative. So not like a highly statistically significant jump, but either having no effect or a negative effect. But that changes with women. So women who view pornography, there's been studies showing that could have a positive
I saw that. That was fascinating to me, because I same with you, is that when I was going over the literature, it seems that like let's say 3/4 of it was, this is not good for your marriage. This is and for seemingly obvious reasons, right? You might be like, you could compare your partner to this. There's a sort of reality might seem a little tamer compared if you have on demand, you know, whatever you want. But I did see a few studies that showed actually. And again, these things are tough because you're going off reported satisfaction and subjective mm-hmm. opinions of like, it'd be impossible to like, how do you objectively prove what is a better marriage? Because even that would be a debate of what metrics do you use, right? Yeah. So I realize this is a very gray area, but it did say there were a few.
It's subjective.
There's a lot of, there was a few studies that showed that there was higher satisfaction for women in marriage who viewed pornography, which I was mm-hmm. like, I was... Yeah, so in the interest of full, like, you know, intellectual honesty, I was like, hey, this is actually not, because as someone who, you know, if you come at it from a Judeo-Christian perspective, you're like, oh, this is bad, you might be tempted to, like, kind of forget some of that science. But I was like, oh, this is actually interesting. The science doesn't always line up on this.
Yeah, I mean, even in those studies, it's not like the universal consensus is that it's always a net positive for women who view pornography. But there's been some studies that have shown it have a net positive effect. Yeah, and then there's studies that show that pornography can have a positive effect on marriage. But if you look at the funding on those studies, and there's a lot of those a lot of the studies that are funded by the porn industry, you know, getting in there and trying to create studies to be able to fall back on, and that's of course a sweeping statement that I'll get criticism for. But
don't
worry, true in a large percent of cases that the funding there's incentives behind how those studies are made.
Well, it's any study, right? We could say that about pharma, we could say that about you know, the meat, egg, dairy, vegan. I mean, anyone's got a vested interest in I'm pretty sure I could make a study say anything with the right amount of resources, you know.
So, yeah, but I wouldn't discount that there's studies out there that have followed all their ethical mandates and have found that porn can have a positive effect.
Well,
we're talking about is how a variable impacts a context. And so a context is going to include different sets of values and how people relate to each other sexually. And like you said, it's subjective. It's not like there's you know, even philosophically, you and I might agree as Christians that it's an objective moral wrong. That doesn't mean that's how it functions anthropologically within society or psychologically within society. But,
oh, no, for sure. Yeah. That's actually one of the things that, like, you know, because generally speaking, I find that many of the sort of biblical precepts or Christian precepts do tend to function anthropologically. Well, like being generous does lead to better social outcomes, and you don't do it because of that, but you just find like, oh yeah, if you mm-hmm. live a life of quiet, if you're peaceful, patient, joy, kindful, joyful, kind, and you give generously, and you are have a perspective that this is sort of a fleeting life and that there's more to come. I mean, there's just so many benefits. It does seem to, that's why I really appreciate Jordan Peterson's like work as far as like mm-hmm. Christianity is sort of this utilitarian, like this does explain the human condition. Also the human condition outlined is like, hey, we are, you know, creatures that are totally divine and special and amazing. And yet we have a big factory flaw that we, you know, we embroidered. So I was like, that makes sense to me. But then you have these things where you're told, hey, this is not good or wrong. Perhaps it's premarital sex or whatever, or pornography too. And you're like, and you find studies that contradict it. And you're like, oh, it exposes this belief. I think that automatically, if I read something's good or bad, it's going to pan out for this world. Right. And that's just not, I guess you could make the case stealing, right? Stealing is a no-no. There are sure cases where people steal and they have, you know, better outcomes in a few areas.
Yeah. It's, well, I mean, it's the difference, and this is good because a lot of psychological schools have narrowed in on this, and it's the difference in something called that contextual behavior science. They call it the difference between process and content. And what that means is you could say, okay, as content, is pornography bad or good as a piece of content? And you can give it a label as good or bad. Or you could say, okay, is the effect of pornography on this process good or bad? Because it looks at pornography as a variable or as an ingredient, you know, in a dish, to use an analogy there. So like you could look at an ingredient and say, is salt like good or bad? Is that a good flavor or bad flavor? Or you can ask, okay, the proportion of salt in the dish of the soup, is it good or bad? And those are totally different questions, because you're not just looking at something for its content, its good or bad quality, but you're looking at it, what's the effect it's having on a context? And so in a Christian marriage, porn is going to have a negative effect, of course, because all the other ingredients don't agree with the content of that, of the salt, you know, for example. But in a context where there's a totally different sexual ethic or a different way of relating, or something that's a lot more fluid, less moralizing of pornography, pornography could have a neutral or, you know, even positive effect potentially. It's very different dishes that you're cooking with. That's not to say anything necessarily about the moral nature of the salt or the pornography. That's just to talk about its effect within a particular context. Does that make sense?
No, for sure. And I mean, truffle salt is objectively, you know, morally a good thing, which I absolutely love.
I'm glad you got my point there.
Yeah,
I'm glad.
That's right. It's about the salt. We are salt of the earth. No, but it's a great, you're right. Cause like, what is your goal? And like, what is the measure? And even how we met, like, that's a great question. Cause what is a good marriage? You could ask, I'm sure there's some shared criteria, but some people might view sexual satisfaction and peace as a good marriage. Some people might view like collaboration and professional synergy as a good marriage. I mean, that brings up a whole can of worms. So I guess to close the loop on that, I'm curious, in your practice, just as one clinician, et cetera, dealing with people from, you know, both secular and Christian and different backgrounds, independent of the whole moral thing, do you, as a psychotherapist, just a clinician in general, have you found, generally speaking, any sort of position on pornography that you'd say, hey, you know, generally it's not great, or it's just too individual to actually make any sort of broad sweeping statement like that?
I think with kids, I put my foot down that it's harmful. And so I think that, like, when I have, especially prepubescent children, like the literature is universally has a negative effect. It can speed up puberty. It can actually change the hormonal structures of kids and how they're developing.
Speed up puberty. Brain development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kids can go into puberty earlier with premature sexual experience, and that includes pornography. That would be chronic exposure. Yeah, not just like one sex scene in a movie or something. But like, you know, there's a literature that's just established firmly that it's negative for children. But as far as like even how it impacts teenagers, how it impacts adults, I don't, as a clinician, I'm not, again, imposing that moral framework on people. I think that I'm going to work with the framework that people come in, because I think my job as a clinician isn't to tell people what I think is right. It's to leverage the psychological tools that I have to help them move towards their version of well-being. And there's limitations on that. If their version of well-being was like murdering people, like I wouldn't help them murder people, but like, you know, so there's bounds, but like generally, at least that's the job. The job of being a psychotherapist is very different than being a pastor, for example. As a pastoral counselor, I'm guarding doctrine. I'm indoctrinating in the sense of, you know, showing people the right way to go and raising the alarm of the wrong way to go. But in psychotherapy, I'm helping the person understand and become congruent with their own set of values. And oftentimes the psychopathology is because someone has incongruency in what they think on something, and it's creating all sorts of issues. Does that make sense?
No, it's all, and I really appreciate it. That's a good distinction, because I think it can be, I think sometimes people forget, like, or they think their therapist is judging whatever. And I really appreciate that, like, you know, you're looking at like, how do I just help this individual, and divorcing whatever presupposed opinions you have. It's just about, you know, it's what they bring to the table. And I think that's good, because I think a lot of people probably don't get help. They might assume that they're getting judged or whatnot. And I think it's cool to hear a clinician say, no, like this, I'm here to work with what you bring me. And I think that's really cool. So, well, speaking of, as we wrap up our time here, speaking of mental health and anxiety and all, man, we got into that's what I love about this. We went somewhere I never would have imagined. It's his fault.
Yeah.
He said the M word first, and it just opened up the can of worms here.
Is that going to get you demonetized on YouTube? You say
No. Just one episode. It's great. No, it's fantastic. No, these are conversations that need to happen.
You have to put the little E next to the thing. Is it explicit just to talk about? That makes me almost angry. Well,
it'd be funny, because there are music videos that I think constitute far more explicit than anything we've discussed here. Also, we've used words like clinical, research, you know, consensus. Yeah. Like we're
not being crude.
Yeah, we're just having fun here. So, all right, let's get some questions here. We asked a few people, just because you're obviously internet celebrity and sensation, gracing us with your presence here, which is fantastic. I guess one question I got, it's half serious, it looks like, but leads me to a real question. What coping mechanisms do you recommend for me dealing with the inordinately high gas prices? all right. So joking aside, that is a real thing, but what do you recommend for people right now who are just, you know, just going, man, the world seemed bonkers a year ago. Just when COVID started to die down and some normalcy came back, Russia invades Ukraine, gas prices are through the roof. Oh, wait, inflation's happening. I guess we're not done with things to worry about.
Yeah. Well, I would say react to the catastrophes that are happening and wait to react to the catastrophes in the future until they get here. And what I mean by that is we can go down the rabbit trail of, well, what happens if World War III starts? Like, what happens if, you know, the housing market crashes? What happens if I lose my job? What happens? And then what happens is we react to the catastrophe before it gets here and experience all the physiological and psychological distress that would bring, like, ahead of time. It's like the opposite of a credit card. You get to pay before you buy anything. And so I would just say, like, go to the, you know, to use that analogy, go with the cash system. Like, when the catastrophe is here, pay with the distress, like experience the distress when it gets here. And that's not saying don't have forethought and be wise, but, you know, there's so little that we can predict in this environment, politically, economically, that I don't know. And this might just be me being naive, but I don't know if there's any reasonable or logical steps that you can take in light of Ukraine and Russia, like on a, outside of putting some extra money in your savings account. And I don't know, like, don't, like, you could think like, oh, I just need to go buy a bunch more Bitcoin or buy gold, or, you know, load up on gasoline tanks. Like, I saw a TikTok of some lady like filling up trash bags of gasoline, just like, I don't know where she's gonna put it, I guess in her shed. Trash bags, not buckets.
Wait,
trash
bags. Liquid in trash bags?
Liquid in bag. Yep. I don't know.
You know what? And that lady probably has more TikTok followers than I do.
Well, so I don't know. That's so. In short, it's
don't
yeah,
do that,
it's,
folks.
It's make the next right choice. Make the next choice that you feel like is wise. Of course, yeah. Be having, like, financially, of course, like, be putting an emergency fund together where if something catastrophic goes down, you're not getting evicted next month. But As far as gas prices, I'm trying to wade my way through that just like you guys are.
Well, I'm here in California where you've not, I don't know if you're sort of Jobian, your ears have heard, but your eyes have not seen the $7 per gallon. So, and so I was in Texas a couple weeks ago and this guy's like, man, this is BS. And I was like, well, he's like, gas was like, he's like, this is $3.95. This is terrible. And I was like, $3.95. I don't remember the last time I saw gas for $3.95 anywhere. This is amazing.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
I saw East Coast getting up close to 10 in some places, at least for short amounts of time. That was nuts.
Oh man. All right. Next question we got is, I hinted at this earlier, but, your hair care regimen, you look fantastic. You also lost weight. You look great. I don't know what you're doing. Most people have kids and it seems that they insulate, you know?
Yeah. I went the opposite direction. Yeah, I got rid of my dad bod.
You became a dad, but shedded the bod. You know? What's your hair care? And then how do you look so great?
Hair care. I am married to a hairdresser. So that helps.
Okay. All right, folks. That's how it looks so good.
It's the cheat code. So I have in-house haircuts, whatever I want.
Universal hair care.
I've had professional consultant for my hair. Yeah. So that's an advantage for sure. I use the Davines. What's it called? Not the pomade, the Davines clay. I think that's what it's called. Davines is the
we'll
brand.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And then the clay. Yeah, I think it's the clay. It's great. It's what Harry Styles uses, by the way. That's what I heard. I don't know if that can be confirmed, but Harry Styles uses that as well. So if you want the hair of Harry Styles and or Mathias Barker, it's the Davines stuff. Sponsored by? No, it's not. That's sponsored.
Right. Hey, I'll call Harry right now and be like, "Harold, this is Harold Styles. I'd like to speak with you." Next question. What advice do you have for creators? You grew pretty quickly. This person wants to know, what advice do you have for creators just starting their channels and putting their content out there? I know you probably get this a lot, but
it's a good question.
You know, yeah.
So some quick pieces that I'm going to try not to make them sound like platitudes, but the first one is it's great content that you would be fine making if you never got paid for it and if you never got famous for it. And that's kind of defeating the point of the question, I guess, but that's not just so that you won't get let down. It'll actually change the quality of your content, because then you'll be making stuff that you genuinely feel creatively free to like make what you find is interesting and that you like, and then the market will assign value to that or not. I guess so. Like there's two routes you can take. You can try to predict the market once and then become that, or you can be a really rich and quality version of what you are, and then the market will either find that valuable or not. That's the crude options. And then there's something in the middle where you do something authentic and then you're being strategic and you're looking for the best way to present that to people where the market can appreciate it. Whether that market is like an algorithm, whether you're starting a business, whether you're artistic, whether you're a musician, whatever, those are the only options, is like do something that you like and that you enjoy, or, you know, kind of anxiously try to predict what's next in the algorithm. Like Casey Neistat once, he's a YouTuber, made this analogy that I liked, and he's just like, it's like there's a spotlight going around of like the public eye, and it's always moving, and you can be running after the spotlight or you can be getting ready so that when the spotlight comes towards you, if it does, you're like, you're set and you're established in its quality. And so would you rather be anxiously running after the spotlight and then trying to build something once the spotlight is on you temporarily? Or would you rather be like doubling down on your stuff and really making it quality so that when the spotlight hits, you have content? And on a practical note, I think it's actually advantageous to have a good 9 months where you don't get much attention at all, because it'll allow you to experiment. It'll allow you to make different things and to try and to fail and not feel like, I don't know, any great amount of discouragement from that or humiliation from that. And then if you do, you know, maybe get like a break, you get shared by a big creator, you get an opportunity to do something, the algorithm starts picking up your stuff or whatever, you have a whole library worth of content so that people can build a connection with you and build a relationship with you. And that's the kind of relationship you want with any prospective audience or customer, is you don't want them just to like, I don't know, like your video. You want them to actually genuinely engage with the thing that you're making that hopefully makes the world better, whether it's your art, your music, your ideas, whatever. And so I would say pick something that you're fine getting no engagement with for a year, and then post as frequently as you are able. that thing at the quality that you feel good about. And then after a year, potentially start to look around and be like, is there ways that I can shift and arrange this that would be maybe more presentable? Because maybe it's not that your art sucks. Maybe you just have a terrible camera and and like your lighting sucks. And if you just change your lighting, you know,
to get Matthias's notes, by the way, folks, I know everyone always asks, how does he do his lighting? Why does he look like he's in like a 70s film, you know, with the cool dim lighting and stuff? So, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like little stuff like that can have a big difference. But no amount of lighting is actually going to turn your content from good or bad to good. But that doesn't mean it's insignificant. I don't know. I hope that makes sense. But
no,
those are some loose thoughts for creators. Do something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Matthias, he has bigger and more important people to meet. Harry Styles, you know,
me and Harry have a hairstyling appointment.
Dude, that would be great. Hairstyled by Matthias. So two last rapid fire questions because we got to get you out of here. First off, do you have a must read book that you're just top of mind? You're like, oh my gosh, read this. It's amazing.
I'm looking around.
Any mice?
No, I'm looking around for a book. I don't know. I've been getting into, I just picked up a book that I think is interesting. I don't know if I should recommend it yet, but I am interested.
All right, what are you enjoying then? Yeah. What are you
enjoying? 48 Laws of Power.
Oh, dude, that book is Robert Greene.
Yeah. Robert Greene. Cool book.
Dude. All right. Well, we're going to have you back on to discuss this book. That book, I read that in college and it freaked me out because it's fascinating case studies of people who employ these tactics. But I left reading that book so cynical about the human condition and felt like this book can only be consumed if you have the guardrails of a strong moral framework. Because
what's cool is he just shares, Robert Greene, he just shares like, here's how people manipulate other people.
Yeah.
Not even necessarily deceitfully. Some of them are, but some of them are just, here's how people gain power over others. Here's just the patterns. And it's not even that he's recommending that you use them.
Right.
He's just like, you should just be aware of them so that when you see your boss doing one of them, you know, that's what he's doing. It's like, it's just good education to know, like, these are the laws by which people manipulate power. And
I don't know, man, it's the Ring of Mordor. I think you start reading that book and you start going, we shall harness this power to defeat evil.
That's, right. That's where a lot of people criticize it. And I was worried at first. I'm like, is this some just weird like Marxian thing? And he's like, no, it's not that at all. It's just like,
cut to Matthias 3 years later as he sits on his throne, you know? Yes, Ryan, welcome back to my podcast. So
I have leveraged all 48 laws of power.
All the hair care is mine. And then what are you working on right now? So we can connect with Matthias in so many ways. You've got your incredible Instagram, which I do have to give you a shout out. I told you this, but I wanted listeners to hear this. A dear friend of mine had a terrible family tragedy, and your video on grief, in particular with moms, just hit it on the head. And he made sure to pull me aside and be like, tell that guy, he just really helped me. So,
I'm so glad.
As a content creator, you need to hear stuff like that. So just know your work is impacting many, many people.
Wow. Thank you. That's so kind.
You can check out Matthias's Instagram if you've been living in Fraggle Rock and have not been able to. My older listeners will get that reference. You can check out his stuff. But he's also got a podcast, which is doing phenomenal. Yeah. I know, because I have clients who advertise on it. So, and
we've
had a great experience. So you should run ads on it, guys. It's fantastic.
Yeah, Canopy's great. Shout out to Canopy. I like him a lot. The podcast has been fun. I've just kind of launched season 2, March 1st. And so I've been busy recording lots of episodes and doing interviews.
What's the elevator pitch? For listeners right now who are like, I am so tired of Ryan talking, I would like Matthias without Ryan. Is that essentially the podcast? So
I'm so sick of Ryan. Yeah, because that's what everyone's thinking. My tagline is moving towards what's meaningful despite hardship. And so it's a podcast on mental health. It's a podcast on lots of different topics in mental health. And it's also maybe a place where I share some philosophy and stuff that I wouldn't maybe outrightly discuss in like a therapy setting, kind of like what we're talking about. Because in a therapy setting, I'd take a pretty neutral stance. But I make a case from a psychological point of view for a few different things. So like I had episodes on why you should get married, like why is marriage a good idea? So that, of course, imposes some value judgments, but I took a psychological angle to it that I thought was interesting.
I'm single, so I'm triggered by this, obviously.
Yeah, triggered.
Trying Matthias, okay?
Yeah, come on, Ryan, get me.
Matthias has given zero referrals, so.
Yeah, no blind dates. But I talked about like why you should want to have kids, like why that's a good thing. I think, I don't know, so maybe responding to, I don't know, just some like things that I see a lot in the counseling office that are just maybe worth considering on a philosophical note. So it's a lot of psychological stuff. Some of it is philosophy. And then, like I'm doing one, I've been working on one right before this podcast. I'll keep working on it after this, on masculinity and three different expressions of masculinity from different psychological viewpoints. And so that'll be fun and interesting. So yeah, that's my podcast. That's kind
of called the Matthias J. Barker podcast.
Yeah. Matthias J. Barker podcast.
Guys, check it out. And it's actually doing very, very well. I know, because the ad rates are not cheap, because it's doing awesome. So that's why you need to do it, because it's amazing. Anyways, Matthias, thank you so much. You are so smart and it is so fun. I find my lexicon increases with every syllable that you utter.
Oh gosh,
I feel so much smarter as a result of talking with you. And I know that you blessed dozens of people around the world today by tuning in. but you're it's just honor to know you and appreciate you beyond your hair. Just a great All guy, right. And I love the work you're doing. Not many people I can dive into Gottman and pornography and Robert Greene with. So thanks for making
for the record, we did not dive into pornography together today. That is not what we did. For anyone listening, that is not what took place on the record. Yeah.
Again, he imposes no moral judgments, though. Yeah. So as a clinician, he would just say, as a viewer, as a parent, viewer discretion is advised. All right. We'll send this episode to post and editing real quick there. So be great. Badly dubbed. But anyways, guys, we've been listening to Matthias J. Barker on I Went Camping With. Check him out on all his social channels. We'll post in there. Matthias, thanks for camping. Next time, we're going to talk about that brain scan.
Yep. Love it. Would love to. Thanks, Ryan.